Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Palestine Exists, a space where we don't flatten things to make them easier to swallow. This isn't a history lesson or a feel-good cultural thing or whatever. It's a refusal and a way to name what's been taken from us, what has been covered up, and what keeps pushing back. We talk history, resistance, politics, culture, etc., etc., and we do it on our terms, not theirs. If you're here, it's probably because you felt it. So before we get into it, I know this is like a different kind of intro, and I know it's been a minute, a couple weeks specifically without an episode. I first want to apologize to our like four listeners. Petra's been sick, and I didn't want to move forward with the resistance series of like without her. It doesn't feel right, and she obviously brings way too much. And this episode, the one I'm currently recording, I already recorded it before, literally start to finish, and the file was corrupted and it was gone. So this is round two. Wish me luck. Petra's resting and healing, and when she's back, she'll come back stronger. She always does. So keep her in your prayers, send her love, and until then, y'all are just stuck with me yapping. So I'm gonna try to hold it down the best I can. Before we like actually start, I need you guys to sit with something obviously that sounds impossible if we had heard it maybe a month or two ago, right? This June, last month, Palestinian families opened flour bags, flour meant to feed their children, and found oxycodone pills hidden inside. It was literally grounded into the flour itself. Gaza officials called it a systematic crime aimed at spreading addiction. And something clicked in my brain, right? Like a puzzle piece, kind of like I've been carrying for years, finally. And it was like kind of like I finally found where it belongs in the puzzle, I guess. And it's not because it's new, but because it confirmed what we've always kind of known. And I just didn't have the, like kind of like the language to, I don't know, to use it. Because ultimately, this isn't where the story starts. It starts with me realizing that when I trace every thread, whether it be prisoner experiments, drug flooding, medical sabotage, deliberate disablement, it's not chaos and it's not neglect, and it's specifically structured, it's designed, and it's systematic research. Palestine isn't just under occupation. Palestine isn't just going through a genocide. It's under experimentation, right? We're not just being eliminated, we're being studied while we're eliminated. And that realization that we're test subjects in the systematic study of how to disappear a people, it reframes everything. Like every checkpoint becomes a behavioral study, and every restriction becomes data collection, and every death becomes a research outcome. So today, I need to walk you guys through what I've been seeing, because once you understand the laboratory framework, you can't unsee it. And I think that's what we need. Maybe we need to stop calling like this a conflict, like not me, I know, hopefully not y'all, but calling it what it is, right? The largest human experimentation program in modern history. So here's what's been keeping me up all night, right? At night, usually. When I started collecting all this research for this episode, Palestinian prisoners being injected with drugs that made them hallucinate, or communities systematically flooded with narcotics while medical supplies were being blocked, or even entire healthcare systems deliberately destroyed, I realized that we've been framing it wrong. We keep calling it war crimes, systematic oppression, violations of international law, and it is all those things, but it's also something else. It's also research. Since 1997, over 1,000 Palestinian prisoners have been subjected to medical experimentation. Public records confirm it. Israeli public records confirm it, right? News outlets obviously like barely reported on it. Nearly half of the Palestinian inmates and certain prisons have been part of group drug trials. Many didn't know what they were given. Some didn't make it out. And some are still living with neurological damage that has no name. They're not being treated, obviously. They're being tested. Human rights organizations say Palestinians are treated like guinea pigs, right? That's not a metaphor. That's methodology. quite literally. We are being treated as guinea pigs in this quote-unquote experiment. And it's not just happening in prisons. It's happening to entire communities. So in 2017, 30% of Palestinian males between 14 and 30 were reported to be using Tramadol regularly, right? 15,000 people showing signs of addiction. And the part that keeps getting erased is the timing, right? Every spike in drug use, it maps, like when you put it on a map, it maps directly onto Israeli military operations. The correlation's consistent, the violence increases, the drugs flood in, and not just in one neighborhood, it's always all the time. And it's not social collapse, and it's not personal failure, and it's not, oh, these people are presupposed to just fall into bad behaviors. It's design. That's what it looks like when addiction is not an accident, but a mechanism. So when flooding a community with synthetic opioids becomes part of the architecture of control, it's a state-run experiment, and they're basically running it on dependency. And so, you know what's fucked up, right? We can talk about these statistics. I can quote the numbers. We can look at the patterns, right? But I feel like when I read them, my body understands them differently. So the thing that makes me feel like I'm like losing my mind is that it's working. Not just the drugs, right? But the research. Like, so they're perfecting these methods. They're documenting the results. They're repackaging them. And then they're fucking reselling them globally. So we see this often, right? Where Palestinian suffering becomes quote-unquote combat-proven technology. So every time I see like footage of non-lethal weapons used on protesters in Chile or Atlanta or Paris or Los Angeles, I wonder, and I ultimately know the answer, was this tested on us first? And it's yes. Or every time I hear about synthetic opioids in indigenous reservations or fentanyl clusters in Black neighborhoods, I wonder, right, were we the blueprint? Because we're not the end goal. I think it's we're the trial run. And I don't know. I don't even think they were hiding it before, but they're definitely not hiding it now. And during the 2023 genocide, when Gaza's local governance collapsed under bombing, something new happened, something that we really haven't seen before. We saw drugs flooded the streets, and it was in broad daylight, and it was being sold openly in public spaces with no fear and no shame, right? Smugglers admitted they coordinated with Israeli contacts. They bought narcotics in bulk. They flew them in using drones. They somehow bypass surveillance systems that catch everything else. Like when Palestinians are literally using the restroom, they're able to, you know, surveil us and track that. But these drone shipments, absolutely not. They were not able to catch that. Like in April 2025, Israeli authorities admitted it themselves. They busted an Israeli drug ring that had been sending shipments into Gaza. And that's not the part that made my stomach drop, right? Because I think we kind of knew this, or we kind of, at least like every time we hear something that they do, we're like, oh, yeah, we're not really surprised because we know that they're capable of it, right? But during the same genocide, an Israeli airstrike killed Gaza's head of anti-drug police. His name was Colonel Ahmed Al-Qudra. And the moment he was gone, reports started indicating, oh, the drugs were spreading noticeably in Gaza. I mean, I don't know. I think that's quite literally how they designed it to operate, right? You kill the man fighting narcotics, and then the narcotics start flooding the territory that you guys control. And that's not war. That's literally a pharmaceutical experiment. It's a study in destabilization. We're seeing actually like a live trial on how dependency spreads in a population with no healthcare, no economy, no police protection, and no access to treatment. And the worst part is that every overdose or every young person lost to sedation, the data is being recorded. They're watching what happens when you eliminate resistance by sedating it, when you replace grief with numbness. And I think what we're seeing is like what they do is when they engineer addiction in a closed system, and then they deny every tool of recovery. Because these pills or these narcotics that were like being flown in bulk into Gaza while humanitarian aid was being blocked, while, you know, medical supplies are being blocked. These are coming in. And you see, while flour is nearly costing 100 USD for a bag, these narcotics are costing a couple dollars a pill. Why is that? Right? I don't know. I think Gaza is a test environment, and the blockade obviously is like a control group. And you see tramadol as the variable, right? Because what they're really studying isn't just how to destroy a people. It's genuinely, it's not a story about addiction. I just want to focus it on that, right? Because it's not about addiction. It's about engineering. It's about the structure and the strategy and the intent that the Israel uses against the Palestinians. So here's where the laboratory logic becomes undeniable. This is the part where like the metaphor ends and infrastructure takes over. Because what's happening to Palestinians isn't just death. It's documentation. The body isn't just injured, it's being studied. And nowhere is that clearer than in the medical system that's been stripped bare on purpose. It's how they do it chemically and quietly, without footage, without the fire. Because we're seeing a genocide in a quote-unquote war with explosions, with the bombs, with the brutality of the deaths, right? But we're also seeing one without explosions, a war that starts with despair and it ends with data. So this is where the lab stops being a metaphor, where violence becomes policy, and how and where healthcare isn't just blocked. It's literally like documented, it's controlled, it's dissected, it's all of these words. Right now, as of mid-2025, the World Health Organization confirms that Gaza's medical system is functionally non-operational. Only 19 out of 36 hospitals are open. And quote-unquote open, you know, when we say open, it doesn't actually mean equipped. It means that there's the building is still fucking standing, and that's it. Of those 19, fewer than half offer anything beyond emergency triage. Most are using mobile flashlights to operate, and they're reusing gauze, and they're rinsing like literally their surgical like gloves. They're rinsing them in tap water that's been, you know, infected, because we know what they do to the water systems in Gaza. They're working under impossible conditions, obviously, with no supplies, no staff, no time, like nothing, while they're being killed and their families are being killed and them trying to save the people who are being killed. Doctors are doing triage on children on floors soaked in blood with no anesthesia, no antibiotics, and nurses are performing surgeries using fucking flashlights on your phone and a piece of thread. This is the reality. The numbers tell us the rest. 94% of Gaza's hospitals have been damaged or destroyed. WHO recorded 28 direct attacks on healthcare facilities in the past few weeks. And since October 2023, it's been 697 total. And that's not chaos. That's not rogueness. That's not any of these things. This is not happening in a vacuum, as we've been saying. Medical aid is being held at the border. Entire shipments are blocked over security concerns or whatever the fuck they're saying. Like, they're rejecting nail clippers. Insulin is being denied. Chemotherapy drugs are sitting in containers being left to fucking expire while cancer patients are dying. While narcotics are, you know, flooding in with ease with fucking drones, tramadol, heroin, oxycodone, basic medical tools are stuck at border crossings for months, right? It's years, actually. And these aren't just like hypotheticals. So I want anyone to sit and tell me how many attacks before it becomes a pattern, before it becomes a method, before it becomes, might I say, intentional, right? 94% of hospitals in the Gaza Strip are damaged or destroyed. 94%. And you need to hold that number up to like up next to this one, okay? Because if you take it out of Gaza and we look into, like, for example, East Jerusalem. In East Jerusalem alone, we have over 20,000 Palestinians who are on disability payments while actively being addicted. So if they seek treatments for this addiction, these payments stop. Recovery here is punished, and they're like sustaining our dependency on these, on this drugs. It's literally framework for what they're doing. So you're not looking at neglect. You're looking at calibrated management of life and death. And I keep thinking to myself, what are they measuring? Like, what are they measuring? How long a diabetic child can survive without insulin? Or how many doses of Tramadol does it take to keep a teenage boy sedated enough to not throw a rock? Or how many amputees can a hospital treat with no anesthesia before it collapses under the weight of untreated infections? They're not just letting us suffer, they're watching us suffer, and they're logging every fucking outcome. We're seeing, and they're studying what happens to an entire population when you flood the bloodstream and you block the suture, right? So when they fucking cause a wound, when they bomb open and they, these bombs that have like shrapnel in them that's designed to actually impale you, but then they don't give you the tools to close it. And it, I don't know. It's an experiment and it's a long fucking clinical trial. And it's not even nationally, it's done on a global scale because there people are benefiting from this. The West is benefiting from this. They're mapping what long-term dependency does to resistance. And they're observing the effects of chemically induced despair. They're learning how long a people can hold on when every survival instinct is punished and every attempt at healing is criminalized. And then they're building models from it. And then they're refining the technique. And then they're going to export it. Because Palestinian hospitals are not just being dismantled. They're being turned into like a negative control groups. This is like, we're all in a global research program on how to erase a people without declaring war. So it's a laboratory and our bodies are the test environment. And they don't just shoot to kill. They shoot to observe. They shoot to record what happens when you don't die. To see how the wound evolves and how the infection spreads and how long you last once the pain becomes unmanageable and medicine is blocked. So during the Great March of Return, almost every gunshot victim who made it to the hospital developed drug-resistant infections. Not regular ones, bacteria that outpaced every treatment the hospital could offer. Bacteria that mutated inside bodies denied antibiotics for years. And doctors were asking, how, why, huh? And the answer, if you're paying attention this entire episode, simple. They weren't testing weapons. They were tracking what happens after, right? Israeli snipers were using Tavor 7 rifles, and it was a newer generation assault weapon designed with a higher caliber and deeper impact. And one shot left exit wounds the size of fists. So people's legs weren't just broken, they were split open, shredded from the inside, and then they were left to rot in systems where rotting is inevitable. And then this is where the data begins. So the wound, you have your first data point. How deep, how wide, how fast it hemorrhages, you know, then the second is the infection. How quickly it becomes resistant, when which bacteria spreads first, which ones survive. And then if the hospital has no antiseptics or no tools or no staff or no electricity, no antibiotics, it's good, right? It's a controlled environment. It's literally a live trial on what happens to a limb or a lung or a child's bloodstream when care is denied by design. And what comes next? The export. Because those same rifles, they're now marketed as combat proven. And combat proven means tested on Palestinian bodies, on our bones, on our ability to endure pain under siege, without anesthesia, without suturing, without anything. But it doesn't just end with the weapon. The shrapnel isn't the point, but the residue is. There's a study in 2012 by Manduka. They found elevated levels of barium, tungsten, mercury, arsenic, uranium, not in the soil samples, in the umbilical cords of newborn Palestinians. Or I'm going to repeat that one more time. I'm going to run that back, right? A study found elevated levels of barium, tungsten, mercury, arsenic, uranium in the umbilical cords of newborn Palestinians. You are born contaminated. Your first breath is already shaped by weaponized metals. Like, your body doesn't just carry trauma. It carries the chemical signature of occupation, of genocide. And this was back in 2012, y'all. So, like, these signatures, they're traceable, and then they're documented, and then they're usable. Because when cancer clusters rise in Gaza, or birth defects triple after a phosphorus bombing campaign, that doesn't just happen. It's observed, and it's written into reports, and it's literally shared in military intelligence briefings or used to calibrate the next round of fire. We're not just, like, targets. We're trials. And our children, born after the bombing, born after the white phosphorus is still in the air, they're being monitored too for what it looks like when a population's DNA is altered by the long half-life of colonial weaponry. And, like, even in death, the body isn't free. Like, it's so fucked because as of this year, Israel's withholding at least 676 Palestinian bodies, some of which have been stored for decades, stored in morgues, or they're buried in numbered graves, and while their families are being denied burial, and their families don't even know where their children or their father or their uncles or their grandmas are. They're literally just stuck in this period of frozenness, right? And autopsies conducted at Israel's Abu Kabir Forensic Institute have removed organs without consent. Corneas, skin, hearts, jawbones, all stripped from the dead. They ostensibly say, oh, it's for study. Obviously, you know, we understand that it's for harvest. And this is confirmed by pathologists. Like, it's so fucked because we see here that the dead, too, is data. They are data. Because bodies withheld aren't just political leverage. It's forensic resources. And it's sites of weapon analysis. They can do reverse ballistic on them, like reverse ballistic testing. They can do residue tracing, tissue sampling. And death becomes evidence, but only for the state. And the violence is ontological, right? Because not only are Palestinians denied not just life, death, but also a meaning to it. A meaning to our life, a meaning to our death. Our body becomes research, our suffering becomes evidence, and even our corpse becomes a variable in somebody else's weapon refinement protocol. And like, we don't even get to say goodbye. This isn't just about the destruction of life, it's about the transformation of that destruction into knowledge. Because that knowledge gets exported. Weapons tested in Gaza get labeled quote-unquote combat proven and sold to regimes in Colombia and India. Crowd control methods that was trialed in on Palestinians showed up in France and in Chile and in United States police departments. Infection data from Gaza's hospital is quite literally cited in pandemic resilience research. Right? So we see here now that a bullet that shatters a teenager's spine becomes a pitch deck. The bacteria that kills a newborn gets logged into medical journals, and the uranium that's found in placenta becomes an environmental case study. We're not just like living under violence, we're producing the future of it. And this is the part that they don't want you to understand, is that genocide can be very, very marketable. Genocide can also be like methodical, right? That like every limb lost or every cell that's altered, every grave that's unreturned is not a tragedy for us. It's also an input for them. A population under erasure becomes a pipeline for strategic intelligence for them. And I think like this is the datification of death, right? Or the commodification of harm. The systematic transformation of Palestinian biology into research infrastructures. And if we don't call it for what it is, which is scientific violence, then we'll keep mistaking it for accidents or misfortune or tragedies. And it's not the, like, this is not the only way that they do it. So, for example, we already know what they did to Ahmed Munasra. We've said his name, who a 13-year-old boy dragged through the settler legal system, left bleeding on the pavement, and then who was locked into a solitary cell, imprisoned for all of his childhood, who was diagnosed with schizophrenia, psychosis, and major depressive disorders before he even turned 20 years old. But Ahmad is not an anomaly. He is the data, right? His mind didn't just break under isolation. It was broken through isolation. It was engineered, recorded, and then obviously justified. His psychosis became evidence and became precedent for Israeli courts and dealings with prisons. His deterioration became usable knowledge in a system that doesn't just detain Palestinians, it studies it. Since October 2023, we have over, I believe this is a lot more, so I'm probably wrong on this number, but over 8,000 Palestinians have been detained, including hundreds of children. All these organizations like Aramir, Beit Salam, DCI Palestine, they've all reported the same patterns. Children who were blindfolded for hours, denied sleep, screamed at, stripped, detained without charge, and increasingly drugged. Psychotropic substances are being administered in custody. And while detainees are reporting memory loss and disorientations and hallucinations or tremors, some are given unidentified pills and others are injected without being told what the fuck is being injected into them. And when systems appear, like them being paranoid or mood swings or cognitive fog, they're framed like, oh, hey, look, this is a result of the drug that we just injected or gave you. No. What they frame it as is Palestinian instability. Oh, this is proof that this person is unstable, right? And it's experimentation, quite literally. Back in 1997, the Israeli Ministry of Health publicly confirmed that prisoners were being used for medical trials. Over 5,000 pharmaceutical experiments had already been conducted on Palestinian prisoners. Nearly half of Palestinian inmates in certain prisons were part of drug studies. And the language that was that we saw was clinical. Obviously, no ethical guidelines to stick by here, right? Of course not, because what is ethics to Israel? Human rights reports from the early 2000s confirmed it, that Palestinian prisoners were being used as pharmaceutical test subjects. They were antipsychotics, for example, sedatives, experimental compounds. Their doses were adjusted and the behaviors were logged and the reactions were observed. And those functions weren't isolated incidents. They were proof of a dual-use regime, basically where the carceral system functions both as a tool of containment and a pharmaceutical laboratory. And I just want us to pause for a second and think about what this means, right? Prison isn't just a place to detain our bodies. It's a space to alter them, to track how different drugs affect our obedience, or how sedation impacts resistance, or how neurochemical disruption changes our memory, our language, our identity, our will to just exist. And this is why forced psychotropic drugging is central to the lab logic, because it converts Palestinians into a neurochemical test environment. You administer a substance, then you isolate the variable, you observe the breakdown, and when the side effects appear, which are, like I said, hallucinations or schizophrenia, disassociation, you don't treat them, you'll document them, and you start filing them and saying, oh, these are, you know, proof of behavioral instability. And then you use them to justify further detention and further testing. And that's the loop, right? So one, you'll induce the trauma. Then two, medicate it without consent. Three, criminalize the reaction. And then four, institutionalize the data. And the most terrifying fucking part of this is that it works. Ahmed Munasra's deterioration didn't undermine the system. It validated it. He became a living example of how effectively childhood resistance can be neutralized, even when he wasn't even he was just out with his cousin. There's no proof he was doing anything wrong. But even then, the possibility of him resisting, look at how they neutralized it. If you get the chemistry right, if you calibrate the isolation, if you perfect the dosage, this is how you neutralize resistance or childhood or Palestinian childhood, right? Because, I don't know, it's about research and replication. And just like how weapons being tested on bodies in Gaza, the psychotropic methods tested on Palestinian prisoners, both of these things get exported. Israeli prison officials, they run workshops on quote-unquote interrogation resilience and detainee behavior management. They lecture on the psychological profiles of non-compliant subjects. They teach other regimes how to drug, isolate, and psychologically dismantle children. And then they called it counterterrorism. So when we say, oh, Palestinians are test subjects, this is what we fucking mean. We mean that they're using prisons as a lab. Military is a variable of that. We mean the destruction of cognitive function is literally policy reform for them or refinement. After all that, you know, it's funny. It's, I don't know, not funny, but like, they still don't know how to predict our resistance. They can calculate dosage. They can, you know, break down the maps of how to break us down, but they can't measure dignity and they can't suppress resistance that they don't see coming. And I feel like every time a child survives that system and every time a prisoner documents the drugs that he was given, every time a parent refuses to let go of their son's name, their experiment fails. The data gets corrupted because Ahmad wasn't just tortured, he was studied. And that study, it became exportable. I don't know. What's fucked for me, right? Ahmad's not alone here, right? We know that they've detained thousands of Palestinians and many of them children. We know that they're blindfolded and they're beaten and they're stripped and they're screamed at for hours, deprived of sleeps. They're forced to stand or hang in painful positions. And they're given unknown pills and they're told they're never going to see their families again. And how long before a child confesses to something he didn't do, right? How many hours of sensory deprivation before hallucinations begin? What dosage of sleep deprivation leads to a full breakdown? And Israeli interrogators aren't just trying to extract information, they're trying to document that. And it fucks with me and it breaks me because how long until when you keep a child in solitary, you're not just hurting them, you're stealing years from their recognition and you're undoing what it means to be a human. You're reprogramming the brain to fear contact, to doubt safety, to, I don't know. When a child goes through that and then they let them go, they're unpredictable. And then what they do with that is they start weaponizing and criminalizing that unpredictability. And then they use that to justify it. It genuinely fucks with me because how long until a child confesses to something that he or she didn't do, and then they do the same thing all over again just because they're tired or they're hungry or right? I don't know, because I think that's what makes resistance not just powerful but dangerous. So we started this episode with oxycodone pills and flowers, or at least like tablets and flour. But I want to be specific. This was in June of 2025, right? Humanitarian corridors are barely open. Gaza is starving. The markets are empty. And there's like no bakeries, no markets, nothing. People are literally boiling seawater so they can drink. Right? Relief trucks are let in, the four of them that are let in through Israeli control. And inside the sacks that are labeled flour are pills, oxycodone, a Schedule 2 synthetic opioid. It's stronger than fucking morphine, highly addictive, lethal in small doses, especially when given to children. And it's not just like loose pills that were found. Some samples were ground into the flour itself. It was literally invisible. And someone engineered that fucking process. Someone calculated heat resistance during baking, how long the compound would remain active in dough. Someone decided that this would be the next iteration of Gaza's pharmaceutical assault. Not drug flooding through tunnels, not forced injection in prisons, not street-level sedation. This time, it would enter through the most sacred axis of survival, food. Because once you've already run these prison drug trials, the, you know, 5,000 plus I've mentioned before, once you've flooded Palestinian neighborhoods with tramadol, heroin, and fentanyl, once you've destroyed every addiction treatment center and arrested their founders, once you've created a pharmaceutical wasteland with zero medication and full narcotic access, the next logical step is to build a delivery system that looks like aid. And that's exactly what flower-laced oxycodone is. It's not a new crime. This is it's an escalated form of this development that has been years in the making, decades in the making. And it's not entirely new because in 2003, a leaked Israeli police report warned of rising prescription drug abuse in East Jerusalem, directly linked to pharmaceutical distribution patterns created under occupation. In the West Bank, black market tramadol spikes coincided with periods of military escalation. In Gaza, entire neighborhoods were documented to have been flooded with opioids just days after airstrikes. In every case, medical infrastructure was destroyed or denied. In every case, narcotics flowed with no interruption after that. And now, the line between narcotic and nourishment has been eliminated. I don't know, it's so fucked because it's quite literally pharmaceutical warfare executed at the metabolic level. It's the manipulation of nutrition to deliver quite literally addiction and sedation to the population. And here's the most important part. There's no way that this happens without logistical coordination. We already know that aid shipments into Gaza are tightly surveilled and every pallet is scanned, documented, approved. Every delivery has a paper trail, the truck inspection records, warehouse logs, which means whoever placed the oxycodone there knew exactly how to bypass or exploit the aid system. The question I start asking, what's the hypothesis, right? If we're looking at this from like a lab or an experimental process, what's the hypothesis? Was this testing for long-term behavioral dampening? Was it testing for neurochemical disruption of post-traumatic processing? Was it testing for how dependency interferes with resistance? Like, what neighborhoods received the contaminated flour? Were they mapped demographically? Like, were they able to pinpoint it? Were certain populations chosen as test zones? Was it mothers, young men, children? Was there a control group? And I know I sound crazy, right? And I sound like I'm old, this is conspiracy, right? But this is quite literally how experiments are designed. Someone is collecting the data, tracking how fast symptoms emerge, how families are reacting, whether addiction spreads faster when introduced via necessity, not desire. Whether, I don't know how to frame this, like whether hunger increases vulnerability to chemical suggestion. So if you're hungry, would that make you more dependent on chemicals? You know, if neurological symptoms are traceable in infants who take this oxycodone pill, because this is what oxycodone does. It doesn't just sedate you. It rewires the brain and it alters your pain perception, disorients your cognition. It interrupts, like it quite literally interrupts the body's regulation of memory and alertness. And prolonged exposure to oxycodone, especially through unregulated doses, can cause vomiting, seizures, paranoia, and complete neurochemical dependency. And if that's what was in the flower, then someone wanted these outcomes. What we have to understand is that as this was happening, Gaza's hospitals were being obliterated. They were all forced to shut down, not from shelling alone, but from complete equipment depletion. So even if you survived the oxycodone ingestion, there was nowhere to go to receive help for it. No antidote, no toxicology, no pediatric oversight, no follow-ups, nothing. And the outcome wasn't only addiction, because that data, once they receive it, doesn't just sit in a file. They quantify it and then they feed it into broader systems of analytics that help refine future control strategies, whether for Gaza or anywhere else that they choose to replicate the same model. And like, this is what I mean when I say Palestine's a laboratory, when humanitarian aid becomes a pharmaceutical Trojan horse. And worst of all, the contamination doesn't happen in secret, obviously. It happened under international observation. The very entities who are tasked with overseeing aid distribution, the ones who rubber stamp the entry of those same flour bags, are quite literally now participants in our addiction. What happens when the experiment, as we saw, is visible, them flooding us with oxy pills, but no one really intervenes? Because what you get proof of is chemical warfare that it doesn't need tanks or missiles or bombs or bullets. You know, all you need is fucking silence and hunger and a bag of flour, and that's it. Sorry, guys. I'm like, I know I'm yapping. We're almost done. Because I think what I'm about to talk about is the part that people don't really like to talk about, because it's procedure and paperwork. Because violence doesn't just come from the barrel of a gun or I'm not a military person, but like the part of the airplane before the bomb drops, right? It comes from an office and from a budget line. Like you don't get 5,000 drug trials on Palestinian prisoners, without the necessary paperwork at least. And you don't contaminate humanitarian flour with opioids unless someone designed the delivery system. And like specifically when it comes to even just physicists or chemists, like you don't deploy dime weapons or white phosphorus or experimental sedatives unless a scientist signed off on that dosage for the amount that is necessary in that bomb. There is an entire research infrastructure behind this violence, and it's institutional. At the center of it is the Israeli Institute for Biological Research. It's called IIBR. And it's shrouded in military secrecy, but it's operating under the full endorsement of the Israeli state. This is a governmental lab with links to the Ministry of Defense, academia, and the pharmaceutical industry. They develop chemical and biological weapons. Their work is dual use by design, civilian-military crossover that masks warfare as medicine. 97. IIBR was the source of the toxin used in the failed Mossad assassination attempt on Khaled Mashhal. When it didn't work and Jordan forced Israel to provide the antidote, the IIBR handed it over. The same place that created the poison also had the cure. And that's not coincidence, right? And it didn't end in the 90s. This is likely the same research infrastructure overseeing the testing of the drugs on Palestinian prisoners, the hallucinogens, the sedatives, the pharmaceuticals that alter their cognition or destroy their memory. And it's not isolated incidents. I think it's protocol. It's a system that treats Palestinian bodies as clinical subjects. What makes this violence so dangerous is that it doesn't look like violence. It looks like paperwork, like science, like safety, like research, and it's progressive, right? It's biosecurity and it's public health. And in the same institution that develops sedatives for military interrogation will publish in medical journals about stress-induced psychosis, and then they'll frame it as a neutral discovery. And we have universities here that are partnering with these labs or military ethics boards who approve these trials. And the violence becomes legitimate because of the scientific nature. I think that this is settler colonialism in its most insidious form. And it's not just destroying life, but it's extracting knowledge from that destruction. It's turning our pain into data and our erasure into evidence. And this is why Palestinians aren't just being killed, we're being studied. And that study is what makes the next round more effective. Every hallucination from forced psychotropic exposure or every infection that's left to rot without antibiotics, every overdose from weaponized flour, that's not just cruelty, it's literally research input. It's a data point in a system trying to engineer a more predictable form of elimination. And that is why the goal of this violence isn't chaos, it's control, and it's predictable. And it's repetitive, because when you study how addiction affects resistance, how sleep deprivation alters a person's testimony, or how confinement produces psychosis, you're not repressing populations here. You're quite literally building a model and a method, and you're writing a handbook that goes global, right? Israeli defense firms sit there and they advertise their firms globally as combat proven. That means tested on us. Palestinian destruction becomes a fucking product line, a curriculum for authoritarianism. And I don't know. I think the biggest thing that they're like afraid of is Palestinian refusal. And by that, I means like despite the synthetic or the saturation of synthetic opioids, Palestinian communities organize underground treatment circles. Right? Parents, they patrol neighborhoods. Former addicts warn others. Community leaders, they trace drug networks and they shut it down themselves. That's resistance, right? Despite the destruction of healthcare infrastructure, families, they repurpose herbs and then they ration antibiotics and then they turn homes, as we see in Gaza, into makeshift clinics, right? Because sometimes resistance looks like keeping someone alive for more than one day, right? I feel like this is all resistance because it interferes with everything that I've talked about in this episode. And this is why they target this refusal more than I think anything else. It's treated so much more like aggressive because when we try to culturally preserve, when we try to preserve our culture, it's treated like a threat. I don't know. I think that when a people who refuse to collapse like they want us to on cue, we're not inconvenient. We're quite literally forcing them to explain their failed hypothesis, I think. Like we see here, Palestinian factions coordinating to track drug pipelines. And they're not just cleaning up the streets. They're quite literally fucking up a state-sponsored clinical trial. Or when we see detainees, Palestinian prisoners go on hunger strike, obviously, they're asserting bodily autonomy, but they're also undermining that control group. They're saying you cannot study the body if the body becomes uncooperative. You can't psychologically break us down if the subject decides to stop eating instead of breaking. I don't know. We see even like joy become defiant to them when we see weddings under siege, or Palestinians celebrating the Iranian missiles, or graduation in rubble, or a boy playing oud in a burned out stairwell, because that doesn't compute. And because the logic of the lab, it requires despair. And every time we insist on life, even if we're damaged, even if it's broken, even barely making it through, it fucks with their architecture of eliminating us, right? Our culture, our people, our memory, everything about it. And I think the goal of the research is to perfect population elimination without making it look like a genocide, right? If the goal of the research is to do that, then our refusal, our resistance is the thing that keeps their hypothesis unprovable. And they want clean test subjects and they want predictable outcomes. And we keep giving them anomalies and chaos. This chaos is where liberation lives, I think. We're wrapping up now, but let's just kind of bring it back to the full circle, right? And this is what I need everybody to just hold on to. We know that now the Palestine is the largest, longest running state-sanctioned experiment in a systematic population elimination disguised as research or security research. Every part of this system is running on research logic, not how to kill, but how to kill efficiently. How to sedate resistance, how to fragment someone's identity, how to stretch out a death for so long, so technical, so bureaucratically explained that no one remembers to call it a murder, right? And this is the logic of settler science. It's not just to remove the native, but to study how removal functions best, with what tools, under what conditions, because if this is a lab, as I've been saying, then it's not enough to say war crimes. It's not enough to only say occupation. You have to admit that the entire institutions like the WHO, the UN, these humanitarian NGOs, these university research centers, armed trade regulators, they're all fucking part of this test environment because it only works if no one calls it what it is. And I think this is why we have to, because when we say Israel is using Gaza as a lab or Palestinians as guinea pigs, Palestinian death becomes a concept, right? Our pain, it becomes trackable on a fucking spreadsheet that they sell. I think that we still refuse to be clean, quote unquote, clean results for them. We're not research material. We're not side effects. Because until they find a way to extract the human from the body, they will always have to contend with that, with what they couldn't measure, right? Identity. Love, rage, memory, refusal, exile, all of these things that make us Palestinian. So we just need to remember that. That's it for today. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. Please take care of yourselves. Again, send well wishes to Petura, my baby girl. Free Palestine, as always, and let's ruin their experiment. As that wraps it up for today's episode, that means we will be commemorating another martyr with Humanize Gaza. Humanize Gaza is a project to make sure our people in Palestine, whether it's the West Bank or Gaza, or our people in Lebanon or in Yemen who have been martyred for our cause, will never be forgotten. You can always find more stories if you head to the website humanizegaza.org, and please subscribe to the newsletter as well. Today's martyr is Khaled Hijazi. Khaled was 2.5 years old. He was a toddler who should have been learning his first words or taking his first steps. Instead, Khaled was learning hunger and learning what it means when there's no bread for 100 days, learning what it feels like when your family has been reduced to eating animal feed, fodder, and barley like animals just to survive. On February 27th, 2024, Khaled was rushed to Kamal Adwan Hospital in northern Gaza. His lips had turned blue after eating bread. Bread that his family had managed to find after months without it. The older children vomited what had been eaten and recovered, but Khaled, who was 2.5 years old, his small body already weakened by severe malnutrition, he couldn't fight what that bread contained. The doctors confirmed what his grandmother, Ibtissam, feared. Khaled had been poisoned. This bread, the basic substance that should have saved him, was contaminated with the same toxic substances found in animal feed. Pesticides, mycotoxins, chemicals meant for livestock, not for children. His grandmother's words cut through every time. She said, "We haven't eaten bread for 100 days. I wish we didn't eat this bread, my grandchild. I wish we stayed hungry and sick." Think about that. A grandmother wishing her family had remained hungry rather than watch her grandchild die from the very food that was supposed to save him. This is what manufactured famine does to families. It doesn't just starve people, it turns food itself into a weapon. Khaled Hajazi died on February 27, 2024 at Kamal Adwan Hospital, not from a bomb or shrapnel, from bread, from the criminal act of forcing an entire population to eat animal feed to survive, knowing exactly what those toxins would do to the smallest bodies first. His story is a sobering reminder of when you systematically destroy food systems or block aid, when you force families to forage like animals, you're not just creating hunger, you're creating a form of chemical warfare that I've been talking about this entire episode, where even a child's meal becomes lethal weapons. Khaled should have lived to see his third birthday. He should have lived to play, to laugh, to grow up. Instead, his death sat there and exposed the calculated cruelty of using starvation as a weapon of war. Allah yirhamu. Allah yirhamu Khaled Hajazi. May your short life and the circumstances of your death never be forgotten. See you guys next week.